Welcome to Earth Matters, environmental justice stories from so-called Australia and around the world. Produced at the studios of 3CR on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country in Naarm, Melbourne, and broadcast across the continent via the Community Radio Network. I pay my respects to elders past and present of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and of the many lands our content reaches. I recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Wurundjeri Woiwurrung land. And I affirm that there can be no environmental justice without justice for First Nations peoples across the globe. I'm Mia Audrey.
Often you find out 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line, a kid that didn't pay attention has now gone on to really dedicate their life to some amazing work.
Today's show is the second of two parts on the tricky and crucial work of speaking with young people about the climate. In the last show, we heard from Tim Winton about his new book, Ningaloo, Australia's Wild Wonder, and from Dr. Lyndon Ashcroft about her YouTube series, Climate Kids. These were inspiring examples of climate advocates using their particular talents to stir wonder, curiosity, and resilience in children as they look ahead to challenging futures. Today, I build on their wisdom with words from two educators on opposite sides of the world. Jonathan Noble is the director of the School of Nature and Climate at Ceres Community Environment Park here in Naarm, Melbourne, which every year delivers climate education programs to thousands of learners. And Brooklyn-based educator Sandra Goldstein-Lennett directs the cultural program at a unique summer camp in Massachusetts called Camp Kinderland, where between canoe rides and nature walks, kids learn activist history, practice protest skills, and come up with campaigns of their own. You'll hear how important these spaces are outside the traditional classroom for giving kids the space and tools to love our living world, and some insights for your own engagement with young people at home, work, or in your community. First up, here's Jonathan Noble, sharing insights from heading up one of Australia's largest sustainability education providers. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me on Earth Matters.
Thanks, Mia.
The Ceres School of Nature and Climate works with learners of all ages, including thousands of school students every year. Can you tell me a little bit about the philosophy behind your work?
Yeah, the philosophy has a number of different roots to it. Sustainability education in general, environment education, if you want to go even further back than that, back into the 60s and 70s. But primarily the philosophy is based on, it begins with the Wurundjeri people in Melbourne and obviously Indigenous culture, First Nations knowledge and custodianship. So we, as an underpinning, we have a really deep respect for First Nations knowledge and their relationship with the land and our place in that land. So that's really important for us. But fundamentally, on top of that, Ceres education, it's about empowering people. That's a very complicated space. But it's really about shaping systems that are fair, regenerative and rooted in community. But there's much more than that. When it comes down to education for sustainability, it's really about where every person comes from. Everyone's a learner. Everyone comes from a different place. We see it as what's our role of working with people in a short time and what's the greatest impact we can have at that time. So if we're talking about a philosophy education, it probably goes back to the a kind of spectrum of where environmental sustainability education came from. Originally, it was something we used to say it was head, heart and hands. You know, it was get your hands in the soil, engage the heart and change will happen. I think more recently, we've extended that and we really talk a lot about the agency of students to take action in a time of really overwhelming sort of change to the environment that we live in and some pretty drastic implications of the way we live our life. So fundamentally, I guess if we want to look through the spectrum, the original information will solve everything. We know that it doesn't. We have too much information now, and it's really not. It hasn't created the change that we want. In fact, arguably has taken us in the opposite direction. The heart side of it, the connection to people or the connection to nature, I think is really critically important. And learning how to do things is important. But unless we add that capacity and drive and support for people to connect emotionally with each other and to understand nature more intimately, then connecting in networks is part of that. But unless we have that together, I don't think we have a complete picture of what sustainability education can be.
Well, you're certainly right to call it an overwhelming time. And I can only imagine that that comes up in your work with kids. The overlapping crises that our environment are facing, including climate change, can be pretty emotionally heavy topics. Do you consider that in the way you design and deliver your programs?
Yes, we do. The weight of what kind of doomsday scenarios for young people is incredibly burdensome for them. And we think that, well, there's quite a bit of evidence to show that if kids are overburdened with this style of this doomsday approach of education, that they can literally switch off and just throw their hands up and walk away. I don't know about your listeners, probably I'm older than them, but in the early 70s and late 60s, and when I was a young child, the same thing happened through the nuclear holocaust, this idea that everyone would be destroyed through the arms race, and a lot of people just threw their hands in the air and couldn't do anything about it. So I think that, to me, has always — I've been working in the space of student empowerment and student voice for a long time through different organisations here in Victoria and in South Australia. And we really believe that not just providing joy, but providing tangible ways of taking action in your own life to influence the community around you and to speak for the voiceless is a really important part of educational design. So we have different layers to that. We try and bring joy to our experiences at Ceres. And in your past life, of course, you were one of those educators at Ceres.
And I certainly was.
You're an exceptional educator and one of those people that was able to translate that sense of purpose to this short-term experience, that not only do they understand that they're physically connecting with nature, that that's a beautiful thing, they're having a great experience with a respectful educator, and we're demonstrating ways that they can make a change and take action. I think that is how we look at how we design our programs. We really need to make the connection between climate change is also a justice issue. And not that we can always teach about justice, but we can certainly demonstrate and talk about it in context of what we're learning. So, the big one, I think, for me is that, we're disconnected from the rights of animals and nature around us, and we need to speak and act for that. So we do talk about that. That's really founded inside the Indigenous way of perspectives of seeing the world. So we really embrace that, so that students realize that, or maybe not realize, but we hope that they take away a sense that custodianship of where we live actually is about eons. It's not just this short-term little snippet. So all of those things are taken into consideration when we design projects and programs.
Yeah, I think that's one of the powerful things about spaces like yours that are outside the mainstream education context, that you're able to touch on all these overlapping justice and environmental issues. Is your sense that that is happening in schools at the moment? How many gaps do you find kids are showing up to Ceres with in terms of their knowledge about this stuff?
Knowledge about climate change is so complex that from a reductionist scientific point of you to understand the biology, the physics, the geography, all of those elements of literally understanding the impact of extracting from the earth and importing that into the atmosphere is it's overwhelming and too much. So from a age point of view, you're probably, from a curriculum point of view, you're probably not even making those connections until you're well into secondary school. The curriculum itself is not designed really with that in mind. It's a learning areas based structure with multiple different learning specialities. And of course, you do have sustainability as a cross curriculum priority with that, but that really depends on the passion of the teacher to make that happen. It's not an obligatory part of the curriculum as such. But there are many fantastic schools out there that are doing incredible work in this space, trying to integrate the outdoor environment into a productive space, or a space where kids can reflect, or a space where they're regenerating endemic species and habitats for nature around them. So it's certainly far from hopeless in that sense. For me, the pinnacle of that are schools that embrace a student voice and leadership mentality, where kids get to lead their own learning, their own context. They're supported to develop projects that aren't don't, doesn't always have to be about waste or biodiversity or water or transport. It can be a deeply social application for them, where they focus on helping the community and other places like that. I think those experiences where they have success in influencing the world around them is the best way for a student to work their way through the system that we have.
Well, I'm sure that we have plenty of passionate educators who are listening in at the moment, and no doubt also many parents who are grappling with how to speak to their kids about climate justice. What advice can you offer for those who are feeling daunted?
My advice would be to really support. Most kids have an innate love of nature. We tend to separate our kids from that. Even now, with mobile devices and constructed information pouring at them from all over the place, there really are limited opportunities for kids to get out and to experience nature. And I don't literally mean, go out to a wilderness and go camping. That might be your thing, but that's really not accessible for a lot of people. I would really encourage young people's, parents to facilitate young people's love for nature, no matter what it is, or love for wanting to address inequality around them. I think there are many ways that you can do that. The main way is to get out of their way and facilitate it and not judge it. To really embrace it and accept the fact that the existing paradigm we have right now is not sustainable in any sense of the word. And we can see that now, not just from climate change, but from so many other social and economic examples. I think get out of their way, embrace it, support them. Don't judge it, connect them with others, and let them know that not only is it okay, but it's actually a real demonstration of their sense of their own power and their own sense of understanding their impact on the world and what they want to do. So just embrace it would be my advice.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan, for joining me and for the important work that you're doing with the school. Appreciate you coming on the show.
It's lovely to see you again, Mia.
Jonathan Noble, director of the Ceres School of Nature and Climate, on giving kids space to connect with the living world and with the fight to protect it. You're listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. We're hearing about the difficult and crucial work of climate communication with young people from educators in innovative spaces outside the classroom. Next up, Sandra Goldstein-Lennett, director of the Culture Program at Camp Kinderland in the United States. Kinderland attracts campers from around Turtle Island, North America, due to its unique offering of, quote, summer camp with a conscience. Alongside traditional camp activities, think parent trap, Camp Kindlin provides kids opportunities to learn about and become active participants in movements for justice and positive change. I spoke with Sandra about what this looks like in practice and what they've noticed about kids' outlook at a time when, particularly within the US, things are getting pretty scary.
Sandra, thank you so much for joining me on Earth Matters.
Thanks, Mia. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So Camp Kindlin, where you're the cultural director, was founded over 100 years ago by labor rights activists from Brooklyn. Tell me a little about what their vision was and what the camp looks like today.
Yeah, so Camp Kindlin was founded in 1923 by workers who lived in New York City and wanted their children to be able to appreciate and enjoy a greener environment just north of New York City. So they banded together, collectively founded this camp, and it was originally a camp that was founded on pretty explicitly communist values. And that has changed, but the general leftist lean of the camp hasn't changed. Obviously, over 100 years, a lot has happened in the world. The issues that people are passionate about have changed, but some of them haven't. And a big part of our camp tradition is to talk about topics that the people who started the camp talked about, whether that's the importance of unions, the importance of anti-racism, and following progressive causes all over the world, not just in your local context. And one other thing about the camp that hasn't changed is its deep commitment to child-centered learning and activism, building the confidence and strength in young people's feelings about their own voices and ability to make change.
Yeah, and this is a distinctive thing about the camp, is this culture program that involves kids learning about activism, communism, progressive Judaism. How does this show up at the camp?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So in many ways, Kindlin is like a normal summer camp. Kids play sports, they swim in the lake, they do arts and crafts, right? They live together, have a good normal summer camp experience together. But also interwoven with that is fairly consistent programming, whether it's political education work, more creative outlets for kids to express their values, their desires for the world. Learning how to live collectively is a big part of the camp as well. And different workers there have different styles of approaching that, but with a sort of central value of cooperative work and working through difference and learning how to really not just live with someone else, but respect and develop alongside them in your understanding of the world. Some ways the cultural program shows up at Kindlin can be anything from our annual events, like we have a Peace Olympics instead of a Color Wars at our camp, where all of the camp is split into teams, and the teams are actually representations of certain movements or historical moments, like ACT UP has been a team, Stop Cop City was a team. We also have more ritualistic memorial events, like a Holocaust memorial and memorial for the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then we have some more fun events, like we have a carnival that has a different theme every summer. We've had one that's union themed or themed around different protest tactics. And we also just have throughout the summer, many artists, speakers, visitors, creatives come to the camp to directly engage with the campers about different ways of making change, to really learn from the kids as well as for the kids to learn from them. The camp is also kind of just full of history and tradition. So whether that's Yiddish texts and Yiddish songs from the founders, the murals made over many summers, the artwork from the last few summers. And the kids and staff are encouraged to bring their own passions to the camp. So if someone comes really passionate about climate change or really passionate about trans issues, it's a huge goal of ours to work that into what we do. We're kind of a ramshackle operation in many ways. And so people who come in who are passionate can really make a big difference, not just in the camp's culture, but also in the kids' lives.
What have you found have been coming up for kids? What kind of passions are they bringing along?
Yeah, different age kids bring along usually different issues that are really dear to them. A lot of the youngest kids will immediately bring up climate change as one of the most important issues to them. It's something that they really feel on an existential level and that they've watched even in just their lives change in dramatic ways. In New York City, a few years ago, we had a quite drastic air quality emergency event where the sky was basically orange, and that didn't used to happen in New York as often as it does now. And for many young kids, that was a game-changing moment where they really felt the impacts of climate change, which are often they only hear about on the news or happening in places distant from their own personal lives. They really felt it in that moment. And so I do consistently hear kids mention climate change. They also do care a lot about racism, police brutality, and gender issues, gender and sexuality. We do have a good number of trans campers who have felt the impacts of the US targeting of trans kids. When you talk to the older campers, you'll hear more explicit talk about colonialism around the genocide in Gaza. And some of them will have a little bit more political development of interest in questions of government, democracy, question of capitalism, different types of alternatives. And I do think as a camp, we don't really have one answer we like to give of what exactly a perfect world looks like. We have certain sort of moral bases that we like to use, like a believing in a possibility of a future with no war, where we are treating our earth and one another justly, where we have peace, where we have worker power. But not everyone agrees how to get there, which issues are priorities. So I think that that sort of healthy debate and conversation, especially among kids, is extremely important for them to build rather than giving them like one answer.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I imagine that there are debates, conflicts, disagreements that come up all the time, as well as the tricky feelings of talking about such heavy topics. I imagine you have parents who have their own feelings about what their kids are learning at camp. What have you found the most challenging about the work that you do?
I think what can be challenging about the work we do at Kinderland can be thought of in a couple levels. So on just the care work level of working with kids, working with young people, and many of the staff themselves being quite young, is that care work is an undervalued form of work. And it's something that we ourselves try to teach our campers to learn how to do, to become counselors through a counselor in training program. But it's hard work. It's a lot of work. And to take care of a cooperative sort of group of kids, you know, getting them all to clean, getting them all to go to activities together in this group setting is really exhausting work. And it's not work that we're able to compensate at the rate that we would want to. So I think that that's one of the big challenges is just always racing against the amount of labor that needs to be put in for an institution like this that doesn't have big donors, doesn't have a lot of money. On the political level, I would say that it is extremely challenging for young people to have healthy political conversations. A lot of political life in the United States, at least, is very isolated. People learn about politics or discuss it on their phones, through their feeds, and they're not used to having conversations one-on-one or in a group setting. And in a place like a summer camp, especially for young people, conflict on the personal level and conflict in terms of political or ideological views are not separate. They will always blend together, whether it's a kid getting bullied because they have different views or because they're from a marginalized group, or it's a political conflict sort of balloons into a whole group conflict. These happen all the time at the camp, and it's very difficult and emotional for people to deal with holding both of those things together. Or to say, maybe I really disagree with this person, or I'm really frustrated that they're not listening to me, but I also need to still live with them in a building. Those can be some of the hardest moments, but they're also often the most generative moments. I guess one last thing that's challenging is that work at a summer camp like this, where you're really intensively working with kids and trying to give them a political education, is so much labor, and then you don't always immediately see the reward of it. You might not change someone's mind. They might not want to listen. They might not want to pay attention that day. And it's not school. They're not getting graded on if they care about the political topic we're talking about or not. They're allowed to just want to be at summer camp and have fun. So it can feel like a lot of work without that much reward. But often you find out 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line, a kid that didn't pay attention during one culture session has now gone on to really dedicate their life to some amazing work. And so I see that happen all the time. So that's a challenge that can feel frustrating in the moment, but definitely can be overcome.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for coming on the show. I'd be loath not to mention the recent political shift that's happened in the city. How's the mood over there?
Oh my goodness, it has been so amazing. We had a meeting of the youth group of the camp that meets during the year in the city, and the kids were just feeling really hopeful. And I think hope is something that is also really hard to bring to young people. They are kind of hopeful by default in some ways, but they also get very sad about the state of the world. It's hard to instill hope in young people without just condescending to them and talking down to them, patronizing them. But I think that young people felt involved in this moment in New York in electing Mamdani. So I think that that will have a long-term impact on a lot of people. Thank you.
Incredible. I'm so glad to hear it. Thank you so much, Sandra.
Thank you.
Political educator Sandra Goldstein-Lennett on sharing hope with children when things are looking grim. You've been listening to Earth Matters, Community Radio's National Environmental Justice Program. I'm Mia Audrey. We've heard from Jonathan Noble about how the School of Nature and Climate gives space for kids to encounter the living world and take responsibility for its future, and from Sandra Goldstein-Lennett on providing a political education outside traditional classroom spaces. You'll find links to the websites for both the School of Nature and Climate and Camp Kinderland in this episode's notes via 3cr.org.au/earthmatters, where you can also catch up on past shows. Thanks for listening. That's all for now. But tune in next week for more environmental justice stories. Earth Matters would like to thank the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial support and the Community Radio Network for getting the program out to you. Earth Matters is produced in the studios of 3CR, NAM, Melbourne.
You're listening to Radical Radio 3CR.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
Awkward Giraffe presents the Festival of Critical Comedy 2025 on the weekend of the 29th and 30th of November, 2 p.m. to 8 at the Melbourne Unitarian Peace Church, 110 Grey Street, East Melbourne. Awkward Giraffe promotes comedy to make you think. Lineup includes comedy legends Greg Fleet and Nick Sun, and the groundbreaking Ridiculousness and Doppelgangster, and much more. Free entry. For more details, see awkwardgiraffe.net. Awkward Giraffe proudly supports 3CR. CR is Radical Radio.
Through our on-air content and community structure, we promote real change for workers' rights, gender equality, environmental action, disability justice, and on racism and First Nations sovereignty.
Do you want to be part of real radical change?
We need you to subscribe. It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Call 03-9419-8377. That's 9419-8377. Or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.